Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Captive State, Wonder Park, 5 Feet Apart, Climax, and Ruben Brandt Collector. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I want to hit is actually a little bit of an addendum to the email I got from Glenda R. last week. And she had actually asked a second question in her email talking about Bohemian Rhapsody and basically said she didn't get why it was such a popular movie, why it actually won stuff, especially editing. And she wanted to get my opinion on that. One of the things that I think Bohemian Rhapsody did is it captured a nostalgia. And I said this when Bohemian Rhapsody came out. It was not a movie that was meant to be even a biopic of Freddie Mercury. It was about the music. It wasn't about necessarily Mercury or Queen. It was about their music. So that's why I connected with people, because that's what people experienced. People didn't experience Freddie Mercury's life. They experienced his performances, and that's where it really connected. And it turned into a concert film, and especially that Live Aid stuff at the end, which was basically a recreation of their Live Aid performance. And I think part of the reason that, in particular, the editing works is because a movie like this is very actually hard to put together. You have to cut it in a certain way and even condense a lot of stuff in there. The other thing it does, because it was a movie about the music rather than the people in the music primarily, it had to be cut to music. If you remember Baby Driver from a couple of years ago, it was edited like a feature-length music video. And especially if you go to Bohemian Rhapsody, the sequence about the song Bohemian Rhapsody tells the story of how the song was made, how it was recorded, the different pieces that they worked in together. They just didn't do a music video of it. They cut the history of the song and the development of the song to that music and with that pacing and energy. And that's, I think, why it won that. But ultimately, it was a popular piece. It caused a lot of people to like it. And I think it was also the right age of something, because even though the Academy's older, the people who are in their 20s, in the 70s, when Bohemian Rhapsody was out, those are the older people in the Academy now. So I think that played into a lot of why Bohemian Rhapsody connected, especially with the Academy. Now, the next piece I want to talk about is that college admissions fraud case that has been going through the news. And the reason it spills over into entertainment, the only reason it spills over into the entertainment world, is because you had two marginally recognizable actresses involved in it. You had Felicity Huffman, who was best known for, she did other things, but best known for Desperate Housewives, and Lori Loughlin, who of course was in Full House, and anytime you turn on any Hallmark channel, you're going to see her floating around in movies or specials or whatever. I wouldn't call these two, either of them, A-list actors. I don't think, maybe Felicity Huffman, like right at the height of Desperate Housewives when she was doing like Transamerica, she might have been inching into A-list territory, but I really don't think, I mean, Lori Loughlin never was. She was just the Jesse's girlfriend from Full House, I think, you know. So it's just that they're recognizable. You've seen them before. And what's funny about this is the exact reason why this is getting so much attention is the reason why these people were able to do that. Because they're celebrities. Just because their face is on TV, you recognize them, you think you know them, but you don't. Lori Loughlin is not somebody who's working as a working mom in like the Full House setting, she's married to somebody who's super wealthy. She has all this wealth around her. Felicity Huffman, she's not somebody just desperately taking care of her kids like in Desperate Housewives. She's got tons of money because she was on that show for ran for better part of a decade. And her husband's a very well-known and successful character actor who's got lots of starring roles here and there, everything from a Jurassic Park movie to Shameless on Showtime, but also under the radar as smaller bit parts. I mean, he's a real working actor, and they got plenty of cash. These are not people who own a hardware store. But what this story shows is that celebrity and money and privilege buy you a lot of stuff. People have always realized that money buys influence everywhere in this society. You know, it doesn't matter what country you're from or what part of society. If you got money, you can buy influence. And what this shows us is the level of privilege. And what also this shows is how stupid they were to basically run it into fraud with funneling charity monies and tax deductible donations and frauding the SAT system. And if any of that goes into an envelope and gets mailed somewhere, suddenly that's mail fraud as well that you can add on to it. There's a lot of problems with this. And I have a friend who posted this on Facebook, and he says, isn't this how it works anyways? And he's right, because if you want to get your kid into a highfalutin university, give him a grant. Somehow that tends to influence the board that makes those decisions. But what this does is this totally reveals that people aren't chosen for colleges because of their academics all the time. In fact, maybe it's even rarer than we thought. I mean, you got these legacy colleges. If you want to get into Harvard or Princeton or Yale, if you have a legacy person, who you're related to has nothing to do with how good of a student you're going to be, period. No matter how much money your parents have, has nothing to do with how good of a student you are. This is not a level playing field, and this shows it, and this shows how even more they try to level an uneven playing field that the kids don't even want to go into these colleges. I mean, the stuff people do to get back on TV, I mean, at least for Felicity Huffman, she's being talked about again in the media, just not in a good way. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. I'm going to hit these two really quickly. The first one is Aladdin. I know I've played this a couple times already, each time a trailer's dropped, but it's so fascinating to watch the evolution of the concept of this movie as they're rolling into release. It opens on May 24th.
Watch this.
Watch out! You done wound me up! You ain't never had a friend like me!
Hey, can you make me a prince?
There is a lot of gray area in Make Me a Prince.
You look like a prince on the outside, but I didn't change anything on the inside.
As you can hear, there's a little bit more of Will Smith. The other thing you can't hear is that they've toned down the blue and at times taken it completely off of him, which I think is important because he looks so bad in that Blue Genie character, and they really are trying to downplay that. And I mean, at least he comes across as a little more charismatic and at least a little bit more nice of a guy instead of trying to mimic Robin Williams' performance. This trailer looks better. The biggest problem I have with it, I'm just wondering what's going to happen to the Jasmine character. The Jasmine character looks like she's there just to be pretty, which is not helping the case of this movie itself. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Late Night, opens on June 7th.
That's our show, everyone.
I came to tell you this year is your last.
What?
They can't replace you if everyone loves you.
Do none of you understand what is at stake here? I am being replaced.
Think about why the show is bad and come up with ways to fix it.
I know what everyone thinks of me, but just because I was lucky enough to get this job doesn't mean I'm stupid enough to lose it.
What exactly is wrong with my bits?
You're a little old and a little white.
What can I do about that?
I have some jokes for the monologue. I shouldn't do this in an English accent, should I?
I'm a big fan of Mindy Kaling. I think she does some great stuff. I love how she ran a lot of The Office and people didn't even realize that. I think the Mindy Project's a very funny show. This one I'm interested to see just because I like her humor. It's one of those movies that I don't want to talk about how she looks in it, but boy, she's had so much work done. She looks less and less like the woman trying to get a job in a late night show and more like the actress who's had too much plastic surgery trying to get a guest spot on the show. I don't know. That's a shame. It's a shame I'm going there and I feel like a pig doing it, but I still, it looks funny. I just hope that it holds it together with, you know what she's trying to do, because I think she's trying to do it. It's like the semi-autobiographical work. But of course, she was much younger when she was doing this, and that's always a struggle that you run into. And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Wonder Park and 5 Feet Apart.
Shake that.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Really quick, before I go into the movie reviews, I was thinking about this in relation to that college scandal that's going on with Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin and a bunch of other rich SOBs who are trying to bilk the system that's already tilted in their favor, for crying out loud. How stupid are these kids? How stupid are these kids that their parents have to pay that much money to get them into college? At that point, just hire a private tutor. It's clear these kids are not interested in doing it, which is another problem with privilege. If you can't get into USC as a resident of California and your parents need to pay $500,000 to do that, how dumb are you? Or how little do you want to go to college? And this shows part of the problems with the college industry is you get all these people going to college. You don't even care about it. It's not even important to them. There's a greater collapse coming with the college industry and the student loans and the cost of college. That's coming up. Just look for that in the next 10 years or so. Anyways, one thing I did notice on this that I think is interesting to mention. There's a movie out there called Admission, and it stars Tina Fey and Paul Rudd. It came out 6-7 years ago, I think. I'm not exactly sure what year it came out. Somewhere around 2010, 2012. Tina Fey plays a college admissions agent, or the person who helps make the decision. She's on the board at, I think, Princeton is where it takes place. And she has to deal with all the people vying for those spots. And of course, you're dealing with the best of the best, where people have, you know, 4.2 grade point averages, and they've been National Honor Society, and they've, you know, had all these different perks and everything. And she's trying to narrow it down to those. And there's a kid that she thinks is hers that is applying, and how she's actually manipulating the system within. It's not a great movie, but it's interesting to watch because it shows the insanity that goes on in college admissions and some of the disingenuous stuff, like that whole legacy thing. Like I said, the fact that your uncle went to a college has no bearing on your ability to excel as an academic student. Absolutely none. Now, yeah, you can sit there and say, well, you know, we're both very smart. And that doesn't mean there's a lot of dumb people that have been born of smart people and vice versa. So this movie's an interesting film. It's a neat one to revisit because you get to see how that internal workings of college choices happens. And it's worth checking it out. They didn't do well. You can probably find it in a used DVD bin if you can find a used DVD bin these days. Anyways, let's talk about the new movies this week. The first one I want to talk about is Wonder Park. An amusement park allows the imagination of a young girl to come alive.
Hello, my name is
Steve. I know who you are.
You know who we are?
My mom and I invented this place, and somehow you came to life.
We're alive? Ow!
What the chuck? Go big or go!
What happened here?
The darkness happened. It brought an army of chimpanzee zombies.
So cute!
But so naughty.
It's time to bring the park back to life. Who's with me?
This is from like Nickelodeon and Paramount, which is odd because it feels way more low rent. I mean, some of the animation is really good. I mean, I will say that. It's some eye-popping stuff. But the story just weighed down because it's about this girl and her mom kind of create this imagination park. You know, they draw pictures and models and stuff like that. And apparently somewhere in the multiverse, this thing really exists because the mother communicates with the chimp that designs all the rides. I know, it's kind of out there. And then the mother gets sick and has to go away for treatment, and the daughter grows up too fast and then sort of tries to push all the childish things behind. And then discovers that the park is real and somehow goes through this almost Narnia-level portal to this Wonder Park that's going to be crushed by this nothingness that's, or this darkness that's coming, which is a bit of a ripoff of the Neverending Story, where the nothingness is coming for the fantasy world. And so she has to try and save Wonder Park, and it's all real, and she's interacting with these characters that she created as a kid. So there's a certain level of fantasy and imagination that's really kind of cool in this movie. The problem with it is it just feels very rote. First of all, it's not for older kids. I mean, this is for young kids. This is like, I don't know. I think like third grade would probably be the absolute limit that a kid would enjoy this movie, maybe even younger. I've got a fifth grader, and I don't think he has a darn bit of interest in seeing this film. So the film itself seems like it's scaled down to a younger audience. And then it just kind of falls into the, I don't want to say politically correct, because it's not really about the political correctness. It's more about what the father should be like. And the father is voiced by Matthew Broderick, but he's sort of this almost cookie cutter. There's no uniqueness to him. And even the mom, who's played by Jennifer Garner, she's like the sweet, loving, oh, you can do whatever you want to. Oh, I'm sick. I gotta go away. And there's no depth to her character. There's no nuance to her. And that even gets transferred to the little girl. This isn't like Inside Out from Pixar, where it was really out of the box and showed the changing emotions of a young girl as she's maturing into sort of those preteen years. This just kind of takes that lowest common denominator. And there's a philosophy in movies that when you start a movie, it's got to be big and crazy and action filled from the beginning so that you catch people's attention. And that's nonsense, because you're in the theater already. They've got your attention. You really have to suck to get people to leave in the first 20 minutes. So you should be able to take your time in a movie to get people up to speed on what's happening in it. So it feels more like it's aiming for home video, that if the kid's not interested in it in 30 seconds, you're going to turn it off and put on a different movie. So it almost feels like it's not even aimed for a theatrical audience. But overall, it's just kind of just a throwaway film with a lot of things you've seen before. So I'm going to have to say that Wonder Park kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about 5 Feet Apart. Two critically ill teens must endure the isolation their diseases thrust upon them as they fall in love.
You're the kind of guy that ignores the rules because it makes you feel in control, right?
You're not wrong.
You think that's cute?
Do you think it's cute?
6 feet apart at all times. You both know the rules.
Nothing's gonna save our lives, Stella.
I refuse to believe that. We're gonna do our treatments together.
Always looking for ways to spend more time with me.
Don't tell me the one time you're interested in some guy, he's also got CF.
I like seeing you like this.
Like what?
Hopeful.
There seems to be a subgenre of teen romance that is hospital romance or sickly romance. There's been a bunch of these movies made. You had The Fault in Our Stars, you know, Everyone Loves Cancer. Ansel Elgort and Shailene Woodley were, I think, the characters. And they both had cancer, and they're both still beautiful, even through all their treatments. There was that Everything Everything with the girl from The Hate U Give, and she was Prue in The Hunger Games, where she was had a compromised immune system and couldn't leave the house. There wasn't even that one Midnight Sun. That's the one with Bella Thorne where she couldn't be out in the sun and it had Arnold Schwarzenegger's kid in it. So this seems to be a popular subgenre of movies. I didn't get to see this, but this looks like it's more of kind of like The Fault in Our Stars, where you got these sickly kids. It's Haley Lou Richardson, who's a gorgeous girl, but even when she's sick, she still looks gorgeous. I mean, it's just that, what's it from Love Story? With Ally McGraw, who, and she was dying of some disease, but she was still beautiful all the way to the end, which is kind of silly. So I don't know. This movie looks like it's just going to be more of the same. I didn't get a chance to see it. They didn't screen it. I can't say I'm heartbroken about that, because now I can just say it gets a preemptive suck and I can move on.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Captive State and Ruben Brandt Collector. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with movie reviews with a couple of them I have seen. First one, Captive State. This is the one I think is going to be flying highest under the radar. It's the one that I think has the most interest. It's the one that I think is the most mainstream. It's not going to topple Captain Marvel. I mean, she's still going to be on top, like, by a factor of 2 or 3 at least. But Captive State is one that I think is catching some people's attention. When aliens invade and rule over the human race, a group of residents in one city fight back.
You have a choice to make. Work for me. Or wind up like your father.
Before first contact, we were fighting amongst ourselves. We needed the legislators to show us a better way.
They're protecting us from anarchy.
Harmony, peace.
It's a lie. They're gonna take everything.
What do you want me to do?
As long as we fight back, we got a chance.
This is directed by Rupert Wyatt, who directed Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which I absolutely loved. I think that was a great way to reboot the Planet of the Apes series, and even that Rise, Dawn, and War trilogy, I think, is a fantastic modern trilogy. If you remember from Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Rupert Wyatt gave it a little bit more of a grounded approach. He really tried to make it a realistic movie, even though you did have apes taking over the world. This one, he really tries to ground the movie and make it like an actual film. So it's not a gee whiz, eye-popping aliens. It's trying to be realistic in terms of what the aliens are and how they interact with humans. The story is primarily about this group of insurgents in Chicago. So I think that the aliens have been here for like 10 years or something like that. And there's this group of insurgents in Chicago that are trying to fight back. And unfortunately, when you're at that level and you're just, you know, a couple little ants in a giant garden, the only way you can fight back is by little tactical strikes. It's essentially terrorism. And I found the most interesting part of this movie is it flips the whole terrorism card. Because most people, you hear terrorist, you either think of somebody trying to do some sort of act of terrorism in America, or this is a little bit more of an allegory to what goes on in, you know, Iraq after the occupation of the American forces. And I think that's what they're trying to do with this one, is to show the aliens are the Americans in Iraq, and our heroes in here are the insurgents in Iraq trying to fight back. And it's not trying to take the Iraqi insurgents' side. Don't get me wrong with that. And I'm not endorsing that. What I'm saying is it's trying to say, hey, when your main characters are the insurgents, you're the good guys. It's like Star Wars. Ultimately, the original Star Wars, A New Hope, that's a movie about terrorists. There's a bunch of terrorists that go in and they blow up a military base. That's what Star Wars is about a bunch of terrorists that blow up a military base. It's just that they're heroes because we identify with those immediate guys. If that movie was told from the Empire's point of view, the rebels, Luke Skywalker and all of them, would have been terrorists. And I think that's kind of one of Wyatt's purposes of this movie, is to flip that card and to say, whether you're a terrorist or whether you're a freedom fighter, whether you're an occupying force or whether you're peacekeepers, it just depends on what angle you're looking at it at. And I think that's a legitimate thing to do. And I think that he does it by putting it in the context of science fiction of an alien invasion. You get farther from the reality of it and you can wrap your brain around it. So most of the stories about this little cell trying to do this terrorist strike onto the aliens when the aliens are on the few times they're going to show up on the planet or not in their bunker down under the ground. It's interesting to watch sort of the very gritty, rustic, industrial Ocean's 11 style that they are trying to put this together of how they communicate with each other and how this group puts this part together and how they can assemble everything while staying off the radar. The problem is it does delve so deep into this one character, this kid who's a younger kid who's kind of being brought in the periphery, and his brother's a leader of this terrorist cell. It seems to digress into that. It gets diverted into that, and it takes a long time to get to the meat of the story, which is the conflict that you have. Now, John Goodman plays a government agent who's trying to track down this terror cell and interact with it and trying to dissemble it. And he's great. He actually is what's holds the movie together. The kid who plays the main character of it, essentially, he's not really that great. He's kind of, anybody could have been in that role. John Goodman's the glue, the acting glue that holds it together. And when the meat finally happens, it's a really interesting movie. It just takes a while to get there. You know, that first hour to 20 minutes, it's a bit of a slag, but eventually it works out. So it's not a great movie, but it's an interesting movie. And I think it's the purpose that Wyatt had in making it is sound, and it's thought provoking in that sense. So I'm going to have to say Captive State kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Reuben Brandt Collector. A psychologist with dreams connecting him to an assortment of famous paintings is caught up in an international game of espionage.
My nightmares are getting stronger and stronger. Characters from famous paintings continue to attack me.
Your compulsion to steal comes from a deeper need. You are missing something in your life. I want you to paint it.
How can I paint it if I don't know what it is?
Trust in the brush. I need all 13 paintings that are tormenting me.
Possess your problems to conquer them.
Exactly.
I've always loved animation, and I'm not just talking about like Disney animation, like Cinderella and Snow White and Little Mermaid and The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast. And I'm not talking about Pixar necessarily, although I love the Pixar stuff or DreamWorks. I like animation in general, and I love international animation because somehow in America, everyone, they see an animated film and they think, oh, it must be for kids. And that's not true. There's a lot of great animation that's not for kids. There's an entire section of Japanese animation that, you know, in the mangas and anime and all that kind of stuff that is not to be watched by kids, but it's fascinating stuff. There's also some great stuff from international markets. You know, I like The Triplets of Belleville is a beautifully animated film from France that is really cool and different and weird. And I think you can do so much with animation, but Americans are just pigeonholed into thinking, well, it's a kid's movie if it's got cartoons to it. I ran into a critic at the Wonder Park showing, and she made a comment. She was like, what does a director do for animation? And I mean, she's a major critic, at least in my hometown. And I'm like, I don't even know how to answer that. Go ask Brad Bird. Go ask Andrew Stanton. Go ask John Lasseter. Go ask Wes Anderson. Go ask any of these people. Go ask John Favreau. I even pointed out, I go, what about John Favreau doing The Lion King? That's all animated. It's computer animated, so it looks live action. So this stupid, just Luddite concept that animation is subpar and in terms of movie, it's not a real movie if it's animated, or it's not done by a real artist or an auteur. No, you still have to have a vision. You have to know where it's going. And you see that with a movie like Reuben Brandt Collector. Now, it's out there and it's different and it pays homage to a whole bunch of art, not just the painted pieces but they are in there. And of course, everyone's kind of looks a little bit Picasso-y, you know, with three eyes or whatever in the movie. So it's this really out of the box look to it. But it pays homage to famous movies like The Godfather and Pulp Fiction, and it has pop music in there that it reflects on. And it's this weird little twisting story, and it's the psychiatrist who is having these nightmares, and he feels that if he collects all the paintings that he's having nightmares about, it will end. And so he kind of gets into this world of art thievery and using some of the patients that he has. Now, the movie, the ending of it isn't as good as the rest of the film. And that's the shame, because it really has some great stuff in the movie, but it's an interesting film and it runs like 90 minutes. It's easy to watch and it's different. Honest to God, it's one of the most different things you're going to see out in the theaters now, and that's worth checking out just for that alone. So I'm going to have to say that Reuben Brandt Collector kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about a review of Climax, The Box Office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews with a new one that is in limited release, so it may not be in your local town. Now, the reason they do these limited releases, a lot of this goes back to the days when you'd have to make a film print. And when you have to release a movie in 1,000 or 2,000 theaters or 5,000 screens, that becomes expensive. Now, the studios could pay for it because they get discount deals on film prints. But if you're a small little independent distributor, you know, it's going to cost a lot to make a print of your movie. And so instead of making thousands of prints, they do like 20 of them, and they'd send them from town to town to town. And that's how they do those independent rock and roll release schedules. Nowadays with digital prints, you can make either a hard drive that you can mail to them or they can download it. So it's a lot cheaper to do it, but the limited release tends to work well for different movies. Now, this one is Climax. Controversial director Gaspar Noé tells a psychedelic horror story of a dance troupe run amok after being drugged.
If you couldn't dance, what would you do? Suicide?
Oh, you're so good.
You like this?
I'm so happy. I couldn't be happier.
First of all, know what you're getting into if you're going to go see this movie. Know who Gaspar Noé is. He is one of the directors that really came on strong about 10, 15 years ago with some very dark, punishing movies. Actually, almost 20 years ago. I think is the movie that he's sort of like infamous for is this movie called Irreversible. And it's got a very, extended, just say a very extremely graphic 10-minute scene in the middle of it. Now, I do not like Gaspar Noé's work. I think his stuff is redundant, and I think his stuff is shallow. I don't think his characters have any depth. I think everything is just about sex. It's all about sex. It's sex, 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 sex. And every driving force in the movie is about sex. And I've never been a big fan of even just people. If your only motivation is sex, I mean, that just is, there's nothing to you. And that's one of the things you see in this movie, Climax, where they have all the dancers in the dance room and they're talking and all the conversations with each other. It's all about sex. Sex with this person, sex with that. So I'm going to have sex with it. It's not even, hey, I saw a great movie, or I'm watching this great TV show, or hey, you know what? My dog did this the other day. No, it's all just about reductive sex. And that's what I don't find interesting in this movie. The other thing, you know, what does is he has these visual techniques. One of his movies, in Irreversible, it starts off, the camera's whipping around as they're going through this club, and it's very disoriented. And you know it's there to be disorienting. But do you have to do it for 10 minutes? No, I got it. After about 30 seconds, I'm like, I got it. You're disoriented. And the other thing is he falls into a lot of cliches. And you see that in this movie as sort of like the different character stories intertwine as they're running into each other and getting more and more freaked out because they're like somebody doped the sangria with LSD. And so everyone is getting progressively more goofy and crazy and psychedelic. At a certain point, I'm just like, okay, I get it. And then they're revealing quote unquote secrets that you know from the beginning. And you see just stupid behavior. And then he does these things where there's an actual rig that you can put on a camera and it can make the camera turn 360 degrees. And he uses that a lot to the point. And even in the trailer, like somebody from Collider, their pull quote, it says, it'll turn the world upside down. And I'm like, that's a bit on the nose. It's a technique that if you use that lens or you use that rig, you can do something really cool with it, but you don't want to do it every 5 minutes or you just lose the point of doing it. You know, do one or two really good shots like that and then let it go. I find Gaspar Noé's stuff punishing and at times really just boring because he doesn't do anything with the story. I mean, his movie Into the Void has a little more of a story to it because at least it goes different places. But a movie like this or Irreversible or these movies just they grind on me and they're boring. So if you love his stuff, if you think he's innovative, go check this one out because it's gonna push your buttons. But if not, know what you're getting into and avoid it because I think that it sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about the box office. Of course, Captain Marvel won last week, and it did extremely well. I mean, Captain Marvel did super, no pun intended. It made $150 million over the weekend, which is really good. It's like, what, like the sixth biggest opening for a Marvel movie. And I think part of that, it's because it's the first female lead superhero. Plus, it kind of opens in a bit of a vacuum. You have this superhero vacuum, and it's a nice launching pad to go to the next Avengers movie at the end of next month. Next closest was less than 10%, which was like How to Train Your Dragon 3 with less than 15 million. And then Captain Marvel, it made like $450 million worldwide, which is a huge number. And these are great numbers for Captain Marvel. It's not at the level of like Black Panther, but it certainly shows the viability of a female superhero and a lead superhero. If you do it right and you have a lot of fun with it, and you still make it a good Marvel movie. And that's going to win again this weekend. Nothing's going to come close. Basically, it's going to make this weekend what it could have made last weekend and still been a big hit. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. Newt Scamander works with a young Dumbledore to stop the rise of a dark wizard.
Take it. We've heard the rumors. Grindelwald had a vision that he would rise to dominance over the wizarding world.
So you're asking me to help hunt him down?
I can't move against Grindelwald. It has to be you. In your shoes, I'd probably refuse to. It's late. Good evening, Newt. Oh, come on.
My wife is a huge Harry Potter fan. She has read all the books and she watched all the movies. She absolutely adores it. And I introduced her to the Fantastic Beasts movie. She didn't see the first one in the theaters. I said, I want to go back and revisit the first one. I still fell asleep in the first one. And she thought it was okay. And then we watched this one, and there's parts of it that she likes with the wizarding world and all the, you know, yes, it's in the past, and a lot of this takes place in America, some of it in Paris or whatever. She likes that, but she says to me afterwards, there's something missing here. And I remember saying that about this movie when I saw it. I go, the Harry Potter movies were about Harry Potter, and all that cool wizarding stuff happened in the background, but it was Harry's story. And each movie, some stories were better than others, but each movie had a arc for Harry to follow. And Newt Scamander is supposed to be that in these movies, but he's already become the man he is going to be. There's really no growth needed for the character of Newt. So you don't have that dramatic arc as strong as you do with Harry Potter, because he's still growing. He's a developing kid, and you can frame it in a school setting and it really works. And it's funny, even I remember when I watched the movie in the theaters, I got the same reaction from my wife when we're watching it, and suddenly Hogwarts shows up and she's like, ooh, Hogwarts. And I mean, gosh, I made her sound like, you know, oh heavens, oh, I have the vapors. That's not how she sounded, but she was kind of excited to see Hogwarts. And it was kind of neat to get back to that comfort zone of Hogwarts and what's going on there. But then you're kind of pulled out. And there's some neat stuff going on in The Crimes of Grindelwald, but it does feel a lot like a setup. And you get to the end of the movie, it has a bit of a downer ending, kind of a Empire Strikes Back kind of an end. And you feel like, oh, they're going through the motions of a trilogy, but I really just didn't feel like there was a whole lot of development of characters in this movie. I mean, it's fun to watch. It's a neat movie, and they got some really cool visuals in there. But it still is. There's something missing in the plot. There's something, you need a character. You need someone's story. And I think that they have missed the boat. They should have made this story about Ezra Miller's character, going all the way back to the first film. Should have told it from his point of view. I think you would have had a much more interesting, or at least really waded into that. That would have been an interesting approach and an interesting angle. They kind of just took the safer angle here, and it's still a fun movie. It's still worth checking out. And there's a bunch of special features on it. There's an interview with J.K. Rowling, and she talks about how she developed the movie, and there's deleted scenes and a couple other behind the scenes videos that autoplay after you're done with the movie. And it's nice. It's, I mean, it's not this super in-depth, dense special features collection, but just wait until they do the box set when all these Fantastic Beasts movies are wrapped up, or at least the first series are, and then you'll get all the special features. But watching this again on Blu-ray, it looks great, and it's a neat movie. It just isn't quite as good as the Harry Potter movies. So I'm going to have to say The Crimes of Grindelwald kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other releases this week include Green Book and The Mortal Engines. And that's it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Jordan Peele's Us, but until then, happy St. Patrick's Day, sláinte. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.